Now we're going to look at the 24th chapter of Deuteronomy, which in the first four verses has one long sentence, a very complex sentence with a lot of interdependent parts and clauses, and one that has been interpreted a lot of different ways and which presents some mysteries into its the rationale behind it and so forth. And yet, notwithstanding all those difficulties in understanding it, it is the only passage in the Old Testament that really takes time out to talk about divorce and remarriage. There are references to divorce in passing, but this is really the only passage that teaches about the subject in the Old Testament law. It says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house, when she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, we haven't reached a period yet, this is all one sentence, puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then... So the sentence is, when all of this happens, now we come to the other part of the sentence, still the same sentence, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. Now, this is not really the place for us to go into an extensive study of what all the Scripture teaches about divorce, most of which we would have to get from the New Testament, although it is an important study. It's an important matter, ethical question for Christians to master. It's just that we have, on a variety of other occasions in the Gospels and so forth, had occasion to discuss it. And it's not the kind of thing we can detain ourselves with all day, which we could if we really allowed ourselves. The main thing here is to understand what this passage is saying and what it tells us about God's attitude and the Jewish understanding about divorce and remarriage. Again, it doesn't specifically say a man should divorce his wife. It does not specifically say that if a man divorces his wife, he should give her a writing of divorcement. It doesn't specifically say that if a man divorces his wife and gives her a writing of divorcement, that she can go and marry somebody else. All of these things seem to be implied, but they're not stated. It just says, if all those things happen, then, and there's another condition too, and her second husband dies or puts her away. So if her first husband divorces her, if he gives her a writing of divorcement, if she marries another man, and if that other man dies or divorces her, if those things happen, none of which are commanded, none of which are even specifically said to be permitted, but if they happen, then what is specifically forbidden is that she cannot go back to her first husband again. So this law really only legislates one thing, and that is, in the event that all these things have occurred, the first husband cannot take her back again. That's the one law that's given here. However, in the course of getting there, it's a long sentence, certainly a sentence that goes four verses, a sentence worthy of Paul. But Paul didn't write this particular one, but Paul wrote some sentences that are 13 verses long before they reach a period. But obviously a sentence that long has a lot of interrelated parts. And the Jews came to understand this to mean that God permitted a man to divorce his wife so long as he would give her a writing of divorcement. Now, that's not stated, but it may in fact be implied. The Jews may have been correct. In fact, it would appear that they were correct, because Jesus would seem to support that they were understanding Moses correctly here. In Matthew chapter 19, verse 7 and 8, The Pharisees said to Jesus, "Why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" They are referring to this passage, because this is the passage, the only passage in the law that Moses said anything about a certificate of divorce. So they're referring to Deuteronomy 24. And they said, "Why did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and to put her away?" Well, technically, as you saw, he didn't command anyone to do such a thing. He said, if a man does that, and then these other events follow, and, you know, if all these circumstances line up in this certain way, then the first husband can't take her back. But he doesn't command anyone to divorce or to give a certificate of divorce. But that is found in the passage. But then Jesus says to them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so." Now, it would appear that Jesus is agreeing that this law of Moses does permit people to divorce their wives. That, Jesus tells us, what Jesus tells us there actually goes beyond what we could have known for sure from just reading the passage. Because the passage doesn't say whether God permits it or not, it just says if it happens. But Jesus agreed, apparently, that this passage, because this is the passage that he and the Pharisees are discussing, and he mentions Moses, that this passage does permit divorce. But Jesus goes on to say that if a man divorces his wife for any reason other than her sexual immorality, and he marries another, he commits adultery, and whoever marries her commits adultery. That's Matthew 19:9. So Jesus would appear to agree that this passage permits divorce. It's not God's desire that divorce occur, but it is permitted. It was permitted because people are hard-hearted. It's permitted because people are sinners. It was not something God had in mind from the beginning when he created marriage, before there was sin. He intended for people to be one flesh, and God would make them one flesh, and what God made one, people should not separate, Jesus said. That is the ideal, that is the goal. Every Christian should desire that no marriage should ever end, Christian or non-Christian marriage. But it was permitted by Moses. And Jesus doesn't come out and say, "But I don't permit it." What he says is, if you divorce for any reason other than fornication, well, then that's not a good thing, and especially if you marry another woman. But that goes beyond what Deuteronomy is talking about. It's not here talking about the man divorcing his wife and him marrying another woman. It's talking about him divorcing his wife and him marrying the same woman after she's gone on and married somebody else. Now, it does say that after she's been with the other husband, if she were to go back to her first husband, he shouldn't take her out because she's been defiled. Some people say she was defiled by remarrying, and that she shouldn't have remarried. But if it was in fact morally defiling for her to remarry, it would be morally defiling because she's not free to marry and she's still her first husband's wife, and therefore her second marriage would be adultery. And if it was adultery, she should be stoned to death, not just forbidden to marry her first husband again. In fact, the way it reads in Deuteronomy, there's nothing that would forbid her to go on and marry a third husband. If her first husband divorces her and she marries another and he dies or divorces her, the only thing forbidden to her is that she marry her first husband again. It doesn't say she couldn't marry a third husband. And we do know that that did happen, because we know Jesus, for example, talked to the woman at the well in John chapter 4, and she had had five husbands serially. In all likelihood, she had been divorced by all of them. And she had had five husbands. And Jesus did not indicate that that was wrong. In fact, he called each of those relationships husbands. He did say she was now living with a man who was not her husband, which implied that she was now doing something that was wrong. Having five husbands, he didn't condemn. There's no way that you could condemn a woman having a husband, no matter which number he was. Having a husband is an okay thing. What's not okay is to live with a man who's not your husband. And that's what she was doing also. So that was her sin. Many people, especially following an ethic informed by Christianity, which we have the advantage of all the teaching of Jesus and so forth, which this woman did not have, they think that she was at fault for having married five husbands. There's nothing in the law to forbid it. And we don't find Jesus criticizing her for it. He just points it out to her. "I know you've had five husbands, and you're now living with a man who isn't your husband." If he was finding fault for anything, it was that last point. So it would appear that under the law, and even as Jesus would comment on it, a woman could have multiple husbands serially if they each divorced her. But what was forbidden was for the man to take her back after she had been married to somebody else. Now, the law does not say that if a man divorces his wife and she remains single for a long time and he remains single for a long time, and then they decide to reconcile, that they can't get back together. It does not say that a divorced couple cannot reconcile. It says if she in the meantime has become another man's wife, and then she's free from that marriage, then she can't come back. There's only a very narrow set of circumstances that this is forbidding. And it's a funny thing that it should even give special attention to it, because there are so many different circumstances of divorce and remarriage and so forth that are common, that no legislation is really given about. But this one case, which is a strange one, and, you know, I don't know of any case like this where a man has divorced his wife, she's married to someone else, later she's become single again, and she got back to her first husband. I'm sure there are cases like it, but that's the only particular circumstance this law talks about. Now, some people think that after a divorce has taken place, then let's give this scenario. A woman divorces her husband in today's world. She goes and marries someone else. And then she realizes that was a sin because her husband was faithful to her, and therefore she's living in adultery in her second marriage, as Jesus said. She said the second marriage in that case is adultery. It's not marriage, it's adultery. Well, then she repents and goes back to her first husband. I've heard Christians say she can't do that, but she can. Her husband didn't divorce her in the first place. This is talking about a man who rejects his wife, not a woman who rejects her husband. If she rejects him and goes off and takes another man, she's living in adultery, no matter what the legal status of that coupling is. It's an adulterous relationship, and for her to go back to her real faithful husband is the right thing to do. But if he has put her away, he has rejected her, her coming back is not an option to her, she has to go and she maybe marries someone else. But after her husband has tainted her like that, has declared her unclean. See, that's how he divorced her in the first place, because he found some uncleanness in her in verse 1. That, I think, is the sense in which it is said she is defiled in verse 4. He shouldn't take her back after she has been defiled. That is defiled by him, defiled in his eyes. He has declared her to be defiled. That's why he divorced her in the first place. He can't just change his mind now and say, well, you were obnoxious enough to me that for me to end the marriage before, but I'm going to overlook that now and marry you again. What guarantee does she have that he won't do the same thing again? If he found something in her that he felt was intolerable to him, then he can't. It's rather hypocritical of him to say, now I want her back. No, she's defiled, remember? You found some uncleanness in her. That was the defilement. Now, she wasn't defiled as far as this other man's concerned. He was willing to have her. You weren't. And this is, in a sense, I think, a measure to keep a man from divorcing his wife frivolously, because sometimes in Middle Eastern cultures, people did divorce frivolously over almost nothing. And even in Jesus' day, there were some rabbis who thought that was okay to divorce your wife for just any reason you wanted to. And I think this law is saying, well, here's a deterrent to that. Although the law here doesn't say what the grounds for divorce really are, Jesus, it waits Jesus to come and say that. He says only grounds for divorce are the infidelity of the woman, sexual immorality. But the law doesn't specify that. But without specifically saying this is and this is not grounds for divorce, it's saying if you divorce for whatever reason, whatever you choose, you are cutting off, in all likelihood, any opportunity to have that woman back. So don't just divorce her over an argument you've had, and then you're later going to regret that you did so, because she can go and marry someone else, and once she's done that, you're out of her life forever. You've given up your options. And some scholars think that this law is also to prevent the first husband from interfering with the second marriage. That is, once he's divorced his wife and she's married someone else, if he decides he wants her back, that he might go try to persuade her to leave her present husband and come back to him. Well, the law would say he can't do that, even if she leaves her present husband. Even if he dies, he can't have her back. So leave her alone. leave that marriage alone. Basically, it keeps the second marriage from being pestered by the ex-husband. Anyway, those are some of the thoughts about this. It's clearly a strange law because it only addresses one narrow set of circumstances related to divorce or remarriage without addressing all the multitude of other variety of scenarios that exist. But it would appear that these may be the reasons, basically to discourage hasty and frivolous divorce, and also to possibly protect the inviolability of the second marriage from intrusion by the first husband who's changed his mind and wants her back. Now, verse 5, when a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year and bring happiness to his wife, whom he has taken. Now, this is a standalone law. It's a man's obligation to bring happiness to his wife. I think the literal in Hebrew says, cheer up his wife. Let him stay home and cheer up his wife. A wife's happiness is defined as a man's concern. So much a concern that it outweighs even going to work, even going to war, when there's a war to be fought, when there's a national security to be maintained. There's something more important for a newlywed man, and that's to make his wife happy. Now, he doesn't have to neglect his duties for the rest of his life, the whole marriage, but a year is given to the establishment of that marriage. Obviously, the idea is they need to have a firm foundation for life so that marriage will not end up in divorce like the ones described in the previous verses. And you need to make your wife happy. And it may take a year to figure out how to do that. So he's got to focus all his attention on it. Getting married isn't something you do in your spare time. It's not something you do as a sideline to whatever else you do in your life. Marriage preempts other important duties. Business, war. I mean, those are important duties of a man. And yet, it's clear that he doesn't just kind of tag a wife onto his life just to, just as a arm ornament or, something like that, a trophy wife or someone to just have around to say he's married or even just have kids with. But he's supposed to actually have a relationship with her, which is conducive to her happiness, and to put aside other things for it. After I had been married to my last wife for some time, she told me that she thought it would have been wise, and she's probably right about this, if when we had gotten married, I'd put aside all ministry for a year. I didn't think of it at the time because, frankly, she was in the ministry too when we got married. She had been on the mission field, and she was doing street ministry. We were both in the ministry. So we got married and became ministering together. But as a matter of fact, probably there would have been some value in just both of us taking time out. Not everyone has the economic liberty to just put aside all business for a year, though. But it was in those days, I think, common for a married couple to live with the parents. So they wouldn't have to pay rent. And probably be fed by the parents and by the wedding gifts and so forth that they got for the first year, so that they could just really concentrate on their relationship. That can't always be done now because, like I said, economic circumstances are such that married couples usually don't live with the parents. They don't live rent-free. They don't receive so many wedding gifts that they can live on them for a whole year, but that was something that was desirable, perhaps a good custom to wish to come back. Maybe marriages would be more stable if that kind of priority was given to the relationship by the man. No man shall take the lower and upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living in pledge. Now, when someone borrows money from you, they have to give you a pledge, collateral, so to kind of guarantee it's that they're going to give you the money back. They're going to pay you back someday. So you take something of theirs, which you hold until they pay you back, and then you give it back. That's what a pledge is. But among the things you can take, you can't take the tools of their trade from them. A millstone is what you grind your grain with. First of all, you need that every day to make your bread, just to eat. And it may actually be that somebody's making their living with that. A millstone, there's an upper and a lower millstone. The lower one is a wheel, usually a stone wheel, that is laid sideways, like flat. And then the other one rolls like a wheel on top of it and crushes the grain. It rolls in a circle around the bottom millstone. Those two together are needed to grind the grain. And you can't just say, okay, I'll take the top millstone from you until you pay me back. Well, how am I going to grind my grain? You can't take either of the millstones or any of their tools of their trade or any of the things necessary for their living. You have to take something that's not so essential to their survival. And it says, if a man is found kidnapping, verse 7, any of his brethren of the children of Israel and mistreats or sells him, then the kidnapper shall die, and you shall put away the evil person from among you. This law itself would condemn what we call Atlantic slavery, the slavery that was practiced in the United States. Once again, people sometimes find fault with the Bible because it doesn't condemn all slavery. Why should it condemn all slavery? Not all slavery was unjust. But there is slavery that is unjust, and the slavery that was practiced in this country was unjust because the slaves were kidnapped and sold. They were kidnapped from Africa and brought here against their will and sold. That's kidnapping. The slave trade should have been put to death. Not because slavery in all of its forms is evil, but in that form, it is certainly evil. And it's capital crime as far as God's concerned. Take heed in an outbreak of leprosy that you diligently observe to do according to all that the priests, the Levites, shall teach you. Just as I commanded them, so you shall be careful to do. Remember what the Lord did to Miriam on the way when you came out of Egypt. Now, it's referring to the fact that God struck her with leprosy in Numbers chapter 12. I'm not really sure why that's mentioned here, because this is really a law about keeping the rules about leprosy that are given in Leviticus 13 and 14. The memory of Miriam and her being struck with leprosy probably is, it's not really an example of keeping those laws, which is what the command is here, but rather it's kind of like remember Lot's wife, like Jesus said, more or less to remember somebody who did a bad thing and they suffered for it. In this case, Miriam suffered from leprosy. But because leprosy is mentioned, it brings Miriam to mind, and it can serve as a warning to those who might be rebellious, like she was on that occasion. When you lend your brother anything, you shall not go into his house to get his pledge. You shall stand outside, and the man to whom you lend shall bring the pledge out to you. And if the man is poor, you shall not keep his pledge overnight. You shall in any case return the pledge to him again when the sun goes down, that he may sleep in his own garment and bless you. And it will be righteousness to you before the Lord your God. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in your land in your gates. Each day you shall give him his wages and not let the sun go down on it, for he is poor and his heart is set on it, lest he cry out against you to the Lord, and it be sin to you. So, this has to do with the way that people who have money and land treat the poor who don't have money and land. Many times poor people had to borrow money just to eat. And, of course, as we pointed out, some kind of pledge would be taken from them. But if you are a rich person who lent money, you would not take a man's clothing as a pledge, his garments or something that he needed to sleep in. That is, you can't make his life more miserable by lending him money. Lending him money is supposed to be an act of generosity. But if you have to sleep cold because you've got his garment as a pledge, then you have not really shown him a mercy at all. And it says, in every case, you should give him his pledge back at night. Well, if you give it back to him at night, then you don't have any collateral from him. But you just take the risk because he's poor. And it says, he will bless you and it'll be righteous to you before God in verse 13. So the idea is do the right thing. Even if maybe it puts your loan at risk because you're dealing with a human being. And it's more important to you that you are righteous in the sight of God than that you have covered all your financial bases and you've got everything secured that way. And that's in contrast to what will be a sin to you in verses 14 and 15. if you oppressed the poor, normally that was this, that you paid a man at the end of the day for his work. People were not rich enough in those days to have a few days' money and food stored up at home. The rich would have those things, but the poor, and there was no middle class. There were a few rich and there were a lot of poor. And the poor were so poor that they needed to work every day to make food for that day, and they had to get paid at the end of the day. And that's the custom you see throughout the Old and the New Testament, even in the parable of Jesus about the workers in the vineyard, that at the end of the day, they lined up to get paid. If you held a man's wages overnight, you were oppressing him. He has worked for you, you owe it to him, and you're supposed to pay it when you owe it. If you hold it, you're letting him down. His heart is set on it. He's kind of hoping to eat that night. It's interesting that he says, don't let the sun go down on it in verse 15. That is, make sure you pay him before the sun goes down. But that's also interesting that Paul used that expression, do not let the sun go down on your anger, where Paul is saying, be angry but don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. Obviously, it means that you should, before nightfall, pay your debt of forgiveness to the person you're angry at. He's borrowing language from this business about paying your debts on time. Don't let the sun go down on an unpaid debt. And so also don't let the sun go down on your anger, because your anger is an unpaid debt. You owe it to someone to forgive them. You don't owe it to them. You owe it to God. And so he commands you to forgive. So don't let that debt go unpaid by nightfall. Now in this passage we read, it mentions verses 10 and 11... that if you lend money to a poor man and he's going to give you a pledge, you don't go into his house and get the pledge. You honor his space. He's a poor man, but you still give him some human dignity. Let him go into his own house and bring the pledge out to you. You don't say, I'm the lender here. I'm the fat cat. I'm the one who can, I'm in control of the situation. I'm going to go in and take your pledge out of your house. No, you stay out of his house. That's his house. You let him go into his house and bring the pledge out. Just show some respect to the guy, even though he's a poor man. He still needs to have his own dignity and his own space for his home and his family. Verse 16, the fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor shall the children be put to death for their fathers. A person shall be put to death for his own sin. Now, this is also stated almost tediously at great length in Ezekiel chapter 18. It unpacks that principle. It might seem that that's violated in some cases, like the Canaanites, where they were all killed, including women and children. Well, the children certainly were being, it was their father's sins that brought that problem upon them. The children hadn't done something, as far as we know. Certainly the infants had not. And also we have a case like Achan, when they come into the promised land in the book of Joshua, and Achan steals the gold wedge in the Babylonish garment, which was to be devoted to the Lord, and Achan has to be put to death for it. But his family had to be put to death too. His wife and children and he were all lined up and they were all stoned to death and killed. And that seems to be children suffering for their father's sins. But I think not. First of all, we don't know that Achan had any young children. His family may have been fairly mature. His booty was hidden inside the tent where they all lived. There's a good chance that his children and wife were all accomplices of his. And I think we have to assume that is true. Because God had a principle. He would not punish children who are innocent for their parents' sins. Now, the Canaanites are a different story. That's a case of a whole civilization being exterminated. No less than Sodom and Gomorrah being exterminated. Men, women, and children died there. But it's interesting also, if a man is not to be put to death for his son's, for his father's sins, then is it correct to say that we are all born condemned for Adam's sins, our father? And the idea of original sin, as it's normally conveyed in theology, is that all humans are born condemned of Adam's sin, even before they commit any sins of their own. And in addition to being condemned of their father's sins, they also have a bent in their own hearts towards sinfulness. These are the two parts of the doctrine of original sin, as it's usually taught, that you're born guilty of your father's sins, And if you die, you'll go to hell. That's at least what Calvinism teaches. Calvinism teaches if a child dies in infancy, it goes to hell. Except some Calvinists believe that a child might die in infancy and yet be one of the elect, in which case it will not go to hell, but some children who die do go to hell because they're not elect. But why would a child go to hell? They haven't committed any sin. Well, they say because of Adam's sin. They're born guilty of Adam's sin. Well, I'm not so sure the Bible says any such thing as that. I don't read anywhere that the children are born guilty of Adam's sin. I do read that we all suffer because of Adam's sin. We all have a sinful tendency. We all die. But the ultimate condemnation at the judgment seat of Christ, I don't think when a person who died as a baby stands before God on the judgment day, that God's going to say, you're going to burn in hell forever and ever because someone you never met named Adam did something I was unhappy about. God doesn't have that as a rule of his justice. He does not pervert justice like that. The father shall not be put to death for the children's sin, nor shall the children be put to death for the father's sins. That is ultimate condemnation. Of course, all people die, and we do all die because of Adam's sin. But that's not our ultimate condemnation, because after we die, there's still more. There's still something more. There's a judgment. There's a destiny. And because of that, certainly all people die because of Adam's sin. That's just because Adam was the human race, and death came upon the human race, and we're part of that race. But ultimate standing before God at the judgment and what happens after that, that's not going to be determined by what somebody else did. It's going to be determined by what you did. The Bible says that everyone will receive the things done in his body, the things he did. Everyone will be judged according to his works, the Bible says. So it's not someone else's works that you're going to be judged by. Verse 17, you shall not pervert justice due to a stranger or the fatherless, or take a widow's garment as a pledge. But you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I command you to do this thing. When you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back and get it. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless and the widow, that Yahweh your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, that is, you beat the branches to make the olives fall down, that's how you harvest them, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for a stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore I came in to do this thing. And this is just the law of gleanings. Gleanings have come up previously in Leviticus, and the idea is that, you know, you take what's a reasonable amount out of your vineyard and your field and your olive yard, but don't take every last grape and every last olive and every last head of grain. Leave some of that for the poor to come behind and they can glean from there. That'll be one of the means by which the poor can be supported. There were quite a few laws, obviously, intended to help the poor. There was the tithe of the third year. There was you could walk through someone's field and take what you needed to eat. And at the harvest time, you could go and glean behind the harvesters. This is how Ruth survived. When she came back from Moab to Bethlehem, she found a man, Boaz, who was harvesting, and she was able to glean with other poor people. You know, the poor people would just kind of come behind the hired reapers, harvesters. And actually, we're told that Boaz told his workers, leave some heads of grain on the ground on purpose for her. You know, not just don't go back and gather every last thing, but actually drop some handfuls on purpose, it says, because he wanted to help her out. Chapter 25. If there's a dispute between men and they come to court, that the judges may judge them, then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, that the judge will cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence according to his guilt with a certain number of blows. 40 blows he may give him, and no more, lest he should exceed this and beat him with many blows above these, and your brother be humiliated in your sight. Now, this idea of beating a crook doesn't sound very humane in our modern society, but this is actually a law that is saying that when the judge issues a sentence, for example, beating is a possible example. There could be other sentences for various crimes, but if the penalty is they'd be beaten, it has to be executed in front of a judge's eyes. He can't just say to the guy who was offended, go out and beat the guy, give him, you know, 35 lashes. 40 is the most that could be given. It could be a lesser number. Because the man who inflicted the lashes on men had to do so under the supervision of the judge to make sure that it was not exceeded. The judge was responsible not only for giving the sentence, but also for overseeing it to make sure that the sentence was not exceeded. Verse 4, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Again, Paul quotes this twice. In both cases, he's talking about the support of people who are in the ministry. In 1 Corinthians 9:9, Paul mentions this as a right that he has to be supported for the ministry, but he mentions that although he has this right, this is a right he has never used. He has never claimed the right to be supported for the ministry. He himself worked with his hands and put aside that right. And in 1 Corinthians 9, the whole chapter is there urging the Corinthians to take on the attitude that Paul has of giving up your rights when it's helpful, when it's helpful to the gospel, when it's helpful for the souls of men to give up your rights. And he gives a number of rights that he has that he does not use, including, he said, the right to be married and to take a wife around with him, the right to be paid for the ministry, the right to eat whatever he wants to eat. But he says, I put aside these rights because of the gospel's sake. And so, although Paul did not expect to be paid for the ministry, he said the only reason he didn't expect it is because that was a right he was voluntarily surrendering. But he did insist that a minister has that right. If he ministers in spiritual things, Paul said, for him to receive back, he said, carnal things, you know, physical benefits, money and support and so forth from those to whom he ministers, that's something that is a fulfillment of this, you shall not muzzle an ox that treads out the grain. The ox is working. Don't tantalize it and tease it by letting it work around the food and not letting it eat any. Don't put a muzzle on it. Let it eat while it works. And he also quotes it in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 18, where he's actually giving instructions about the support of elders in the church. He said the elders who rule well should be counted worthy of double honorarium, double honor. And he means support. And he quotes this verse about it. And he says, especially those who labor in the word and doctrine, but he said he gave other instructions about the elders too there, but here he was saying that the elders were worthy of support because of their work. And he quotes this verse here. Interestingly, in 1 Corinthians 9:9, when he quotes this verse, he says, does God care for oxen, or does he say it altogether for our sakes? And then he answers, it's for our sakes. This is not really primarily a concern for animal rights. But on the other hand, although it's not primarily a concern for animal rights, since God had a bigger issue that Paul identifies here, it does suggest compassion to animals. It does suggest not being cruel to animals, too. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. In Latin, husband's brother is the Latin word lever, L-E-V-I-R, lever. It's Latin for husband's brother. And so this law is called the law of leverite marriage. This is what it's always been called, the law of the leverite marriage, the brother-in-law's marriage duties. If a woman's husband died leaving no child, she has to marry his brother if he has one. And the first child will be named after the dead man, so that the inheritance and the name of a man of Israel will not die out. It shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of the dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. Now, presumably, she now is the wife of her former brother-in-law, and she could have other children which now are named after her present husband, her former brother-in-law. But the first child of that marriage has to be named after the dead brother. And this would be a situation where polygamy might be actually mandatory, because the husband's brother might already be married, but he still has the duty of raising up a child to his brother's wife, to his brother's name. That's called the duty of the husband's brother. But if a man does not want to take his brother's wife, and this could be imagined if the wife was particularly obnoxious, and there would be women who, I mean, I'll tell you what, I could imagine the wives of some of my brothers, not my blood brothers, but Christian brothers, that I would not wish to have the duty of marrying them if the brother would die. There are definitely women who would not be desirable as wives, and one could imagine that being the case sometimes, that a man's brother dies and the widow is some of the guy never got along with. I never got along with my brother's wife, you know. I mean, why would I want to marry her and have children with her? So there would be cases where a man might refuse to step into that role. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate of the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to raise up a name for his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he stands firm and says, "I do not want to take her," then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who has his sandal removed." Now, this act of taking the sandal off, it's hard to know exactly what that represents. The sandal could represent the land. Every place the sole of your foot you set shall be yours, God said to Abraham. And it may be that the land inheritance, which should have been perpetuated by the brother raising up a seed to his brother, is being forfeited, and therefore his sandals taken off as an emblem of that. It's hard to say. This custom had changed a little bit in the days of Ruth and Boaz, because it was a few hundred years later. Boaz was a kinsman of Ruth, and she was a widow, and a childless widow. And so a brother of sorts, or a relative, was supposed to marry her and raise up children for her deceased husband. Boaz was willing to do it, but there was another kinsman closer in relationship who had the first right of refusal. And so Boaz went and talked to this other man who was ahead of him in line, according to these laws. And the man said, "You know, our brother's widow Ruth is here. Yours is the right to redeem her." And the guy said, "Okay, I'll marry her." But then Boaz said, "Well, but there's some other legal, you know, obligations to come with it," which he delineated. And the man said, "Oh, well, I don't want to do it then." And so Boaz married her instead. But the man who turned down his right to marry her, actually there was a ceremony that was performed that had to do with the sandal, but it wasn't exactly the same ceremony. If you look at Ruth chapter 4, where this is found, it's just after the book of Judges, because it occurred during the period of the Judges. In Ruth chapter 4, it says in verse 8, verse 7 and 8, "Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm anything, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was an attestation in Israel. Therefore the near kinsman said to Boaz, 'Buy it for yourself.' So he took off his sandal." Apparently, the man who was in line ahead of Boaz to redeem this woman and the inheritance and so forth, he took his sandal off and gave it to Boaz. It's like saying, "Okay, my right of inheritance I'm giving to you." And it's a little different than this procedure, but it was probably something that developed out of this. It's just probably an evolution of this custom that came along, that if a man refused to marry his brother's widow, she would spit in his face in a public ceremony and take off his sandal, and he would be called the man who's from the house of him who had his sandal removed. Anyway, this law of Levirate marriage This is something that has been mentioned in the law previously, but even before the law was given, it was practiced as a custom in the Middle East. And we remember it was relevant to the household of Judah, because Judah had three sons, and the first one died childless, and his widow, Tamar, had to marry the next son in line, and that one died childless too. And of course, it was the obligation and the custom of the culture for the next son in line to marry her, but Judah withheld her from him. And so we can see that even before the law was given, the Middle Eastern peoples just intuitively saw the appropriateness of this, that a man who died childless was a tragedy. That's the end of his life. It's sort of like that's the only eternal life they knew of, was to be perpetuated on this world through your descendants after you die. And for a man to die with no descendants was to be considered a great tragedy. And so a man would do this for his brother, to give his son a descendant to carry on his name. Verse 11, if two men fight together and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of the one attacking him and puts out her hand and seizes him by the genitals, then you should cut off her hand. Your eye shall not pity her. This is a very strange law, because in most cases, although Islamic law often, you know, prescribes the cutting off of hands for people who steal things and stuff, physical mutilation was not a normal part of the punishments that were prescribed for crimes. Of course, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, stroke for stroke, and so forth, does suggest there would be situations where mutilation would be the appropriate penalty for someone who had caused similar mutilation to another person. And maybe in this case, there is the assumption of mutilation too. A woman who's trying to help her husband out in a fight. Now, I'm not sure how she'd get in the position to do this. Two men fighting it out. I don't know how she'd get close enough or in the right position to do this. But obviously, a woman knows that if you want to incapacitate a man, he's got some very sensitive organs there. And she would no doubt seek. I mean, she's not trying to do something sexually arousing. She's trying to do something damaging. So she might actually do something to injure a man's genitals and therefore to render him impotent or sterile. And that, you know, she might help her husband in other ways without violation, but if she interferes with the reproductive capacity of an Israelite, remember reproduction is very important to them, then, well, that's just something she shouldn't do. I mean, she can box the guy's ears if she wants to, but she can't mess with his family jewels. That's going to be something that has to be left alone. And it's so serious, in fact, that her hand would be cut off for doing such a thing. It says, you shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light. You shall not have in your house differing measures, a large and a small. Remember, this is all about marketing practices of having deceptive weights that you use in the scales to act like you're giving more of the product than you are, or giving more money than you are. These things were done by weight and scales, and so they have a separate set of weights that were not accurate in order to favor your own side of the transaction, was a common practice and one that was forbidden. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God has given you. For all who do such things and all who behave unrighteously are an abomination to the Lord your God. So, you know, piety extends not just to what you do at church, but what you do at business, at the office, in the factory, in the marketplace. Being honest and fair in your business dealings is part of the obligation of a godly person. It may seem mundane. It may seem carnal to be concerned about business practices, but there's nothing carnal about it all. It's part of being just and righteous, and that's what God cares about more than religious and pious. Verse 17, remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt. The Amalekites, they were the first to attack Israel when they came out. They had a war with them in chapter 17 of Exodus. That's the war where, when Moses' hands were in the air, Israel prevailed. When his hands were down, Amalek prevailed. But they eventually prevailed against Amalek and defeated him. It says, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. Now, we aren't given that detail in Exodus. We're just told in Exodus 17 that Amalek attacked and made war with Israel, and they fought back and defeated Amalek. But here it tells us more detail. Actually, Amalek did this in a really a treacherous and rather dishonorable way. They picked on the weak. The stragglers at the end of the line who are too tired, they're the ones that Amalek picked on instead of picking on someone on their own side. Therefore it shall be when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around about, meaning the Canaanites, in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess as an inheritance, that when you've done that, you're going to go after Amalek, who's not one of the Canaanites, but there's still an unfinished penalty owed to Amalek, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, you shall not forget. It was after the time of the judges, pretty much, when Saul became king, that Samuel gave Saul the commission to go and wipe out the Amalekites, which he didn't do. He killed most of them, but he kept the king alive, and that was a rebellion against God on Saul's part that actually lost him his kingdom. But it was the fulfillment of this particular command of Moses, which almost 400 years later, Saul was told to go and carry it out. I guess it had to wait until they had a king to lead them. At least that's how they figured. Chapter 26, and it shall be when you come into the land which the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance, and you possess it and dwell in it, that you shall take some of the first of all the produce of the ground, which you shall bring from your land that the Lord your God has given you, and put it in a basket, and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. And you should go to one who is priest in those days, and say to him, I declare today to the Lord your God that I have come into the country which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket out of your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God. Now there's more, but this is apparently something they do with the first harvest once they come into land. Not every year. They do have to bring the first fruits to God every year. But this whole ceremony suggests that they are here acknowledging that they have now come into the land. They're bringing their first fruits of their harvest the first year and acknowledging that this ceremony is probably a ceremony that they only had to do one time. It would be a little time-consuming if every Israelite had to come and say all these words that we're going to read. And you shall answer and say before the Lord your God, my father was a Syrian, about to perish, and he went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number. And there he became a nation, great, mighty, and populous. Now, to refer to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, especially Jacob, since that's the one who went down into Egypt, and his sons, as a Syrian may seem strange to us because, well, he was a Hebrew, and he was really of Mesopotamian stock, if you go back far enough. That's where Abraham was from. But you see, the Israelites really were Syrians, in a sense. They lived in Syria for a long time. Most of them were born in Syria. That's where Laban was. Laban was in Syria. And Jacob had gone down to Syria, and he got his wives. His wives were Syrians. He himself was partially Syrian because his mother Rebecca was from the same place, Syria. Jacob was half Syrian, and his sons were three-quarters Syrian because their mothers were Syrians. And so, and Jacob himself, who was only half Syrian, lived in Syria for 20 years, the very years that his family was being formed. So there's every reason to speak of him as a Syrian, just like I could call myself an Oregonian, having lived in Oregon for 16 years of my life, though I was not born there. He lived there 20 years, had his kids there, and all his kids were Syrians, at least three-quarter, because their dad was half Syrian and their mothers were full Syrian. So to say I was a Syrian or my father was a Syrian is quite true, and went down to Egypt. But the Egyptians mistreated us, afflicted us, and laid hard bondage on us. Then we cried out to the Lord God, our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and looked on our affliction and our labor and our oppression. So the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with outstretched arm, with great terror and signs and wonders. He has brought us to this place, and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land, which you, O Lord, have given me. Then you shall set it before the Lord your God, and worship before the Lord your God. So you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given you, and your house, you and the Levite and the stranger who is among you. And when you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, which is the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled, then you shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the holy tithe from my house, and also have given them to the Levite, the stranger, and the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. I have not eaten any of it when in mourning, nor have I removed any of it for any unclean use, nor given any of it for the dead. I have obeyed the voice of the Lord my God, and have done according to all that you have commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation from heaven, and bless your people, Israel, and the land which you have given us, just as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. Okay, so they're supposed to bring their first fruits and their tithes. This law has to do with the first fruits, apparently the first harvest of the first year they come into the land, and then also every third year when they bring their tithe, the one that goes to the Levites and the poor. Now, we saw earlier a reference to this third year of tithing in Deuteronomy 14, and it was not real clear, and the rabbis themselves had to make kind of a call about this, whether the third year was the regular tithe of the third year or whether it was a secondary tithe besides the ordinary yearly tithe. Because the yearly tithe was said to go entirely to the Levites, but this third year tithe was specifically to be also for the poor and the stranger and so forth. And so it may be an additional tithe. That's not clear. But in any case, when they bring the third year tithe and when they bring the annual first fruits, which would include their tithe too. No doubt they would bring the tithe the same time they bring the first fruits. Or maybe not. Maybe they'd bring the first fruits and then later bring the tithe when it was at the end of the harvest. Not really sure. We're not given a lot of detail about when all this was done. Obviously, it was done at the appropriate time of the agricultural cycle. Verse 16, this day the Lord your God commands you to observe these statutes and judgments. Therefore, you should be careful to observe them with all your heart, with all your soul. Today you have proclaimed the Lord to be your God, and that you will walk in his ways and keep his statutes, his commandments and his judgments, and that you will obey his voice. Also today, the Lord has proclaimed you to be his special people, just as he has promised you, that you should keep his commandments, and that he will set you high above all the nations which he has made in praise, in name, in honor, and that you may be a holy people to Yahweh your God, just as he has spoken. So Israel had the opportunity to be the chief nation in the world, to be set above all the nations which God has made, high above them. And that would be, of course, conditioned upon their being obedient to his command. Sadly, their subsequent history is a testimony to the fact that they didn't value that very highly, and they didn't bother to meet the conditions. They didn't keep his commands. They didn't stay loyal to him. And therefore, as we see, they have not become the greatest of the nations in the world. All right, now, when we come back from a break, we'll find that chapters 27 and 28 are concerned with blessings and curses, and the blessings of obedience and the curses of disobedience. Chapter 28 in particular is an extremely long chapter, 68 verses, about as long as two other chapters. So we're going to try to get through it anyway, through chapters 27 and 28 in one session, because it's all kind of one stream of consciousness there, one thought. But we'll take a break and come back to that. Mm-hmm.